On a cold January day during the Second World War, an American patrol plane was crisscrossing the North Atlantic. And one by one, its engines failed. And ultimately, the pilot had to ditch the plane in the stormy waters of the ocean. The three-man crew managed to escape into a rubber dinghy. They huddled together there against the cold. And suddenly one noticed that there was in the water a bottle. And they reached out and brought the bottle into their little dinghy. They opened it up. And inside there was a note which said, "To the finders, whoever they may be, I, the genie of this bottle, offer the gift of the response, the positive response to any wish they may have." And the three men, the three young flyers, thought about their wish. And one said, "You know, I come from San Diego, and it's warm there, and I'd love to be home in the warmth with my family." And off he went. And the second one said, "You know, I come from Miami, and it's probably even warm there, and certainly my family's there, and I'd love to be home with them." And sure enough, off he went. One man's left alone, shivering in the dinghy. And he says to himself, "You know, I come from Cleveland. And it may be colder in Cleveland than here in the North Atlantic. The one thing I know is I'm cold. I'd like my friends to be back." I'm glad to have a few warm friends here this morning. And I guess this story, which as you probably surmised is a rabbinized version of a Polish joke, is as good a way as I know to get to the theme of the morning. The question before the West, particularly before our own country, this last month, has been what to do, if anything can be done, about the rather brutal crackdown by the Polish communist government of General Czarnecki on the free trade union movement which had emerged in that country over the last 18 months. Hundreds have been imprisoned. Newspapers have been closed. The trade union movement has been disbanded. Universities have been closed, and we're told that they can open again only when their faculty is verified, which seems to be a process which is a cross between being vetted by the FBI for security clearance and making one's profession of a loyalty oath to Senator Joe McCarthy. In other words, Poland is back again under the heavy hand of a autocratic, tyrannical communist government. And the West, which saw the possibility of their developing in Poland something of in the order of a free society, is frustrated, unable really to know how to respond. We recall two previous instances of movements within the Soviet bloc towards freedom: Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia in 1968. Apparently, there were some contingency plans about what to do if the Soviets again crossed a border to put down a rebellion by people. But the next war is very rarely like the last war. And in this case, it was not a small cadre of those in power who had moved to gain power that would free them from Soviet domination, but rather a kind of grassroots movement among workers to achieve the rights and the freedoms which workers understandably believe they have every right to demand. Now, the response of the West, of the United States at least, has been verbally quite powerful. In terms of action, much less strong. We have denied to Polish fishermen the right to fish in our waters. We have denied to the Soviet and to the Polish government the right to import technological equipment and machinery from the United States. We have cut off the number of flights of Air Flot and of the Polish airliners into these United States. But we have not cut diplomatic relations. We have not called in the debts of the Polish government to Western banks. We have not taken any kind of economic or action which could be called a truly effective sanction. And our allies have not been willing to go that far. They have, under some pressure, the last meeting of the NATO agreed to condemn the actions of the Polish government, but they have not been willing to end their trade with the East, and for a number of reasons. The first is that their trade in technological equipment and machinery is much more important in the balance of trade of their those countries and is with us. We tend to send to the Soviet Union raw materials, particularly agricultural food products, rather than the sophisticated machines. And second of all, there's a real fear in the Germany particularly, but in Europe generally, that if enough sanctions are put on the Polish government, they will default on their debts. And in the last 10 years, the bank loans which have been offered by Western banks to Poland have been sizable. They run into the billions of dollars. And there's a great fear that if the Polish government were to default on these loans, the whole banking system in Europe particularly might be shaken to its foundation. And so we've had the strange relationship develop between some financial circles in the West and the repressive government of General Jaruzelski, both eager to see to it that repression remains and that the trade union movement is aborted, not because the bankers in the West necessarily want that, but because they are very much afraid of the consequences for themselves if loans which probably ought never to have been made in the first place are defaulted and they have to accept those kinds of losses. Now, as a Jew, my first reaction to this whole mess is to say, well, let the Poles have it at them, each other. And I really couldn't care less. I don't know a country in the world where the poison of anti-Semitism runs deeper. It's interesting, is it not, that just in the month since General Jaruzelski has imposed his government and destroyed the Solidarity movement, the emergence of virulent anti-Semitism has been heard again on the media and the newspapers of Poland. A great deal has been made of the fact that two of the members of the Solidarity Central Committee, a man named Bronislaw Geremek and a man named Adam Michnik, come at least from Jewish backgrounds. The day after the takeover, a certain Professor Kosecki was given an hour of time on Warsaw television for a diatribe against Zionists and against Jews, whom he claimed had taken over and subverted not only Solidarity, but the interests and activities of the Roman Catholic Church in Poland. And the leading cardiologist of Poland, a man named Dr. Marek Edelman, one of the great heroes of the Polish resistance to the Nazis during the Second World War, was immediately incarcerated, and only a great deal of pressure from the West has secured in recent days his freedom. We tend to believe, most of us, that Jewish life in Poland ended with the Holocaust. And of course, 3 million of Poland's 3.5 million Jews were destroyed by the Nazis. What we forget is that after the Second World War, about a quarter of a million, maybe 300,000 Jews, remained in Poland or returned to Poland, largely from the Soviet Union. And that immediately after the end of the war, there were any number of vicious pogroms by Poles against these Jews. led by Poles who had expropriated the houses of Jews, the businesses of Jews, and who didn't want to return these to their rightful owner. The police stepped back. In towns like Kielce, Jews were murdered openly on the street and no action was taken to protect them. And so in 1945 and 1946, well over half of the Jews who had returned to Poland fled, preferring the insecurity of a displaced person camp in Western Europe and the uncertainty of their future there to remaining in their homeland. It's well to remember that there are documents which quote Herr Himmler as explaining the reasons that the German government was building the death camps in Poland rather than in Germany, by saying to those who were organizing the final solution, "We can trust the Polish masses as being reliable in this area. We cannot trust the German masses in the same way." Of those, probably 80 or 90,000 Jews who did not flee in the 1945, 46, 47 era, their attempts to rebuild any kind of group life were defeated by Stalin and the Stalinists who were in power. Ort and JDC and groups of this type were refused permission to operate in Poland. And when in 1956 there was a new struggle of power after the death of Stalin, both sides in that struggle blatantly used anti-Semitism as a weapon against the other. And all but 30,000 of Poland's Jews fled to the West, or wherever they could flee to at that time. And then again in 1968, when there was another struggle for power between disciples of Gomułka and the disciples of Mr. Gierek, again, Jews were made the scapegoats. Mr. Gomułka, you remember, said that Jews in Poland must make clear to everyone that their loyalties are to Poland and not to the Zionists. And there was at the time a minister of interior by the name of Mokhtar, who adopted a policy called Polonization, which was based in the idea that no Jew should have a role in the apparatus of the government. They were a minority that was not to be trusted. And at this point, all but 9,000 or so Jews who are now in Poland, most of them elderly, fled the country. And so we find ourselves with a handful of Jews in solidarity, 9,000 Jews in all of Poland. The Polish government, the Polish spirit, still expressing this old, vicious anti-Semitism. When Poland was, for a brief period in this century, a free country, the Jews of Poland ceased to leave in the great numbers they had left to up to this First World War. The Jews knew the nature of the people among whom they lived. And for a while, they were able to enroll in universities. They were allowed to enter the professions. But the period was brief. And by the end of the 1920s, the early 1930s, Polonization, the removal of Jews from the professions, the denial of Jews to place on university rolls, was in full swing. And by 1939, a fact which many have forgotten, one-third of all the Jews of Poland, one-third of the 3.5 million Jews of Poland, depended entirely for their support on overseas relief, relief by Jews of Jews. And so if a woman with a Jewish memory looks out at what is happening to Poland today, their one hope is that whatever action is taken by the West or by the East, it will not lead to another world war, that really these people are not worth our concern, which of course is an unworthy position to take, even as we feel it. Jews came to Poland well over 1,000 years ago. There was a synagogue in Poland long before there was a church. Jews were brought into Poland in large numbers in the 13th and 14th century by the kings, particularly Casimir the Great, who looked upon the Jewish community as creative and as the group which would provide him with the special skills, literate skills, which would allow him and his party to develop the great natural resources of Poland. And the Jews who came to Poland in those early centuries were granted rights that they enjoyed nowhere else in Europe, including the right to bear arms. And they, in fact, did a great deal towards developing the farms and the forests and the incipient factories of Poland, adding to Poland's wealth. But because they served the king and they were a foreign group, the Roman Catholic Church, which has always looked askance, at least in medieval times, upon the Jews having any role in government, any say over Catholics, began to unleash one of the most vicious and poisonous anti-Jewish propaganda campaigns which could possibly have been put together, and continued this drumbeat of the Jew as the Christ killer, the Jew as the deicide, the Jew as the pariah, the Jew as the outsider for centuries. Church disciplines and orders that were published by the Polish Church from the 15th century on are among the most viciously anti-Jewish pronouncements that the Church made anywhere in the world. And ultimately, they poisoned the spirit of the peasants, the serfs of Poland, and they made the Jews seem to be the guilty of all of the poverty and of all of the insecurity and whatever misfortune occurred to them. And they were insisted in this by the German artisans and craftsmen who wanted to take over from the Jews the places of privilege which they enjoyed under the monarchy. And they brought into Poland a more literate anti-Semitism, the pamphlets and the books, and the claims, the spurious claims about Jews doing this or that and the other. And the result was that by the 15th, 16th, 17th century, you had incidents of the blood libel, claims that Jews were poisoning the host, the whole panoply of anti-Semitic claims, which we know all too well. And so when the doors of the West opened up in the 19th century, the Jews of Poland tumbled out as fast as they could. Because Poland had not been allowed to develop its economy in peace. It suffers from geography. It lies on a flat plateau land which runs between the German states and the Soviet Union. It's the battleground between East and West in Europe, inevitably so. And so armies marched across one way or another, the Lithuanians, the Swedes, the Germans, the Austrians, the Russians, the Cossacks. They marched and countermarched, and of course the poor and the peasants and the serfs suffered the most. And whatever plans the kings may have had to develop their country often fell victim to these military actions. In the 18th century, there was several attacks by the Cossack hordes, and then the three partitions of Poland in the late 18th century, which ended the independence of that country, as it was partitioned between Prussia and Austria and the Tsarist Russia, an independence which remained lost until the end of the First World War. Poland then represents for the Jew pain, anguish, anti-Semitism, and a recognition really deep down that the Poles have never been able intelligently and to manage their own affairs. We had to be brought in to manage their affairs for them, and they, in a sense, couldn't allow us to do what needed to be done. And so I suspect that for many of us, the inability of government to adjust to solidarity and the solidarity to adjust to the government is simply another proof of what seems to us to be a basic incompetence. But times change, and people change. And Poland has been moving out of medievalism at a very fast rate in the last 20 or 30 years. And though we bear within ourselves all these old wounds and all these old scars, I think it would be very unwise for us to not to recognize that what we are seeing in Poland is, in a sense, the convulsions attendant upon any society as it emerges into the modern world. If you think back to your grandparents or great-grandparents who may have come from Poland or that area, you'll know that from their own lives they moved from a medieval world into
through America to the 19th or 20th century in the 6 weeks or whatever it took them to go by ship from Danzig or Stettin or Hamburg to the United States. Well, if the Jewish community was still in the Middle Ages, so was the Polish community itself. And whatever attempts were made in the 19th and early 20th century to industrialize, to urbanize Poland, were to a large degree undone both by the Second World War and by Russian economic and political actions after the Second World War. You recall it was Russia's undertaking after the Second World War to turn Eastern Europe into a vast colony, which would provide the raw materials and the foodstuffs for her economy and for her community, and would provide a ready market for the finished products which the Russian government would send in. And so the Russians dismantled whatever factories there were. They reduced Poland to a primitive agricultural base, and they undid the economic developments of the pre-war years. And so in around 1955, 1960, as Poland began to reindustrialize, as Stalin's policies had proved feckless and self-defeating, she began with very little. She began with an untrained workforce. Most of the members of Solidarity are in their 20s and 30s, and they come from the small villages of Poland where their fathers for generations before were serfs or peasants or simple men, illiterate men of the fields. As Poland has moved to industrialize, she's had to face the same kind of challenge which has been faced by each and every one of the countries of Eastern Europe. And that is that you must make accommodations with Marxist ideology in order to accomplish your ends, that state planning from above is not the best way of adjusting to the realities of the marketplace. Now, in a number of Eastern European countries, Hungary and Yugoslavia being the prime examples, there's been a willingness on the part of the government or an understanding of the economic reality to the degree that a certain amount of democracy has been allowed in the factories and the marketplaces, that the technocrats have been able to have a say which outvotes that of the party commissar, whose expertise is in ideology, not in producing a particular piece of machinery, and that the voters, the workers themselves, meeting in small workers' groups, are allowed to talk through the means of production, talk through the kind of product they will produce, the quality of the product they will produce, and the wages of the workers are to some degree adjusted to the profitability of that factory. The result is that in those countries, at least, the quality of the work and the efficiency of the workforce has been increased. In Poland, on the other hand, the heavy hand of central planning has been retained throughout, with the result that not only is the Polish workforce inefficient, but that many of the products it produces are unsaleable. They are not of the quality, of the variety, or the kind for which there is a market. And in the last 15 or 20 years, despite the vast amounts of money that Poland has invested in her economic infrastructure and machinery and factories, money is largely gotten by signing for long-term loans from the West. She has not been able to increase the profitability of her economy, and the wages of the workers has remained low, and the morale has remained lower yet. And it becomes increasingly evident in a country like Poland that despite the ideology of the Communist Party, that they completely and totally represent the interests of the working class, in point of fact, those who are the cadres, those who are the Popular Workers' Party of Poland, the Communist Party of Poland, represent the interests of the party. They are political interests, they are bureaucratic interests, they are their own interests, and not the interests necessarily of the working man. When the strike at Gdansk in spring of 1980 was able to win from government a number of concessions, among the most important to the workers was that the special stores and special privileges, which were the prerogative of the apparatchnik, of the party workers, should be disbanded, that everybody would be able to buy at the same stores and only at those stores. There would not be a two-level society with privileges only for party members. Poland's economy stumbled. Poland became heavily in debt to the West. And already in 1970, when there was the first strike at Gdansk, a strike which was rather brutally put down by the Polish army. There were clear indications that something was wrong, that the whole ideology which legitimizes the communist movement was awry, that the Communist Party was over here and the workers' interests were here. And so the whole ideology which legitimizes the left had to be rethought, because in fact it was not effective. 1976, in Warsaw, there were bread riots in the coal mines of Silesia. There were strikes. And finally, when in the summer of 1980, the shipyards in Gdansk went on strike, strikes and similar movements for an independent trade union movement developed throughout the Polish nation, almost instinctively. It was a movement from below. And the demands of these, what became to be called Solidarity, were essentially these: that there be an independent trade union movement in Poland, that the government be forced to release accurate economic figures so that trade unionists could have some understanding of the decisions that they must make, that workers in factories would have a say in the production schedules and the quality demands in the product lines which were being produced, that all privileges of the Communist Party bureaucrats be rescinded, that strikes be allowed, there be increase in wages. And all this was done under a proviso that there should be an understanding that the communist government would have a leading say in the final decisions. And this was the fly in the ointment, because in a country that is communist, economic decisions can really not be separated from political decisions. They are the obverse and the reverse of a single coin, because the political apparatus, the government, is also the economic planning apparatus. There is no independent planning function. And so although the workers in August of 1980 agreed that the communist government should have a leading say in all of this, it was never made clear how this, in fact, would operate. And we did watch with growing amazement the ability through strikes and confrontations of farmers to create their own union, of the universities to develop a degree of freedom that they never had before, of libraries to be open so that anyone could go in and read, of newspapers to begin publication of things which were not pre-censored by the government, a degree of freedom which had not existed since the Second World War in any East European nation, and which set up vibrations of empathy and sympathy throughout the West. The question was, could the needs of the workers be resolved in any kind of secure way without the workers ultimately confronting the state and the power of the state? Now, the Communist Party changed its leaders. Jurek was put out. Kania was brought in. Kania was brought out. Were put out. Jaruzelski was brought in. A number of senior party officials who were accused of mismanagement or feathering their own nests or of bribery or other crimes were released. But wherever you look, throughout Poland, there were 1.5 million of these Communist Party bureaucrats who made every decision as to production and distribution, as to censorship, as to the organization of the community. And in each case, what Solidarity was doing was threatening their well-being and their security and their power. And on the other hand, the membership of Solidarity, though it tried to walk a fairly cautious line, was being pushed from below by young people, young workers in their 20s and 30s, the first truly workers' socialist movement in all of history, to move further faster. They were impatient. They felt that unless they solidified their gains now, they might never get the freedoms and the higher wages and the job security that they sought for. And on the other hand, from the West and from the government, there were concerns that all of this turmoil was in fact making the Polish economy operate less effectively rather than more, and that the Poland was more and more in danger of becoming a bankrupt state because she was so concerned with all of this inner turmoil and the efficiency of the factories and the output of the factories had not increased. And so there was a strange symbiotic relationship developed between many of the banking interests of the West and the governing interests in Poland, because efficiency, central control seemed to be the way which would allow the Poles at least to move a step forward towards solidifying their economy. And finally, from at a meeting in November at Gdansk, it became clear that Solidarity was moving towards challenging the whole idea of the authority of the Communist Party. They wanted free elections. And at that point, it became clear that the government would move against them and move against them effectively and efficiently. They did. And so we return to our original question. What can be done, what should be done by the West, if anything can be done, in order to support this democratic movement, this movement of workers with which we must have sympathy, this movement which points up for all the world to see the hypocrisy of the communist claim that their interests, however a communist government defines them, are similar to and parallel to the interests of working classes throughout the world. I'm afraid that the simplest answer is that there's very little that can be done by the West in order to support Solidarity. Unless we're willing to move in militarily, we cannot overthrow the government. And the West, and America too, must be conscious of the fact that world wars tend to start in Poland. Danzig, Gdansk, was the issue which was the immediate cause, the proximate cause of the Second World War. It's the battleground between West and East, a natural battleground. And if we were to move into Poland in any way militarily, not only would we be threatening the vital interests of Soviet Union, World War III, but we would turn that rather virulent strain of Polish nationalism against us, where now, in a sense, it is more sympathetic, at least in the underground sense, than it might otherwise have been. The world simply will not get freedom because freedom is the right of all people. Jews suffered in the ghettos of Europe for hundreds of years before emancipation. And if you'd ask any rabbi of the time, how are we to be free? The answer had to be a combination of patience, prayer, teaching the young about the traditional values of the people, biding your time, until the economic and political realities which surround us will allow us to break out of the walls of the shtetl of the ghetto which have been imposed upon us. What's interesting, I think, historically is this, that in Eastern Europe, and also incidentally in China, economic reality, as it intrudes upon the communist state, tends to lay the groundwork for the development of a certain independence of spirit among the working class, which I believe must ultimately lead to new forms of government for those parts of the world. It is simply not true that you can, from above, by order and by force, shape an economy which will be effective, responsive to the complexities of the marketplace, and prosperous. It hasn't worked any place in this world. There needs to be central planning, and there needs to be motivation. There needs to be the active involvement of the worker. And as our industry has become more complex, the worker needs to have greater freedom to use his mind, to invent, to bring in the suggestions which allow for greater profitability and greater efficiency. Those countries in the Eastern Bloc, like Hungary, which have allowed for a measure of independence among their workforce, have seen the standard living of the entire workforce raised and their economy has become more prosperous. Those like Poland, which have not allowed this, have seen their economy falter and stagnate. And so, strangely, Marx, in a sense, I think, is on the side of the Democrats. That is to say that economic realities in time will create a working force which is no longer peasant, no longer illiterate, no longer brutish, which will demand certain rights, which will no longer tolerate some party loyalist telling him, this is what we must produce because in Warsaw or in Moscow or in Peking, this is how it was decided. He will see that it makes no sense to continue along this particular way and will stand up for his opinions. Economic reality, I think, will continue to create the kinds of working class spirit which we saw explode in the various unions which came to comprise Solidarity. And if this be true, then it would seem to me that the proper strategy for the West would be to make it as difficult as possible for the economies of these countries to emerge, to make the governments increasingly dependent upon the skills of their own people. The more they are dependent upon their working class, the more power that working class has. The shipment of our professionals, the shipment of our technocrats and technicians and sophisticated equipment into the Eastern Bloc does precisely the reverse. It says that one person trained operating a can operate a factory, and I can keep the rest of the people of that community in, as serfs, doing my will as in some kind of rather meaningless labor-intensive undertaking. But if I force by my actions, or help to force by my actions, a society to turn in on itself and develop from within the skills, the technologies, the advanced techniques which are required by a modern economy, I'm creating precisely that human resource, which is by the fact that its minds has been developed democratic in interest, attuned to the very same concerns which are of concern to us. So it is unfortunate, in my estimation, that the West has not been able or willing to embark on an embargo of technologies to the East. It is unfortunate, in my estimation, that we have tried to force feed through our bank loans the industry of the East, made it easier for them to move into competition with us, not because we fear the competition, because if politics be what I think it is, it reflects the economy of a country. It's only as this proletarian group, Solidarity represents, ceases to be a mass and becomes a highly skilled group of workers who understand what they're about and who are willing and able to take responsibility for their tasks and for their jobs and for their factories. It's only then that we will create in these countries a countervailing force to the bayonets and the secret police and the governmental controls which now exist. And if we can't confront directly, because of the Yalta Agreement, because of the realities of international politics, the bayonets and the secret police and the armies of these countries, then at least it seems to me we ought to be doing all that we can to help those who are ceasing to be human animals and becoming human beings, ceasing to be beasts of burden, and are becoming highly sophisticated, highly trained workers, men and women of independent judgment, so far as we help to stimulate, to create that kind of working force, where we will make possible sometime in the future the kinds of new arrangements in these countries which will add to the measure of freedom which the workers rightfully want to enjoy. And so in a strange way, I think the Jewish experience is useful in terms of the Polish experience. The one thing the Jewish life never allowed itself to do was to give up its standards, to give up the schoolroom, to give up the books, to give up the learning which encapsulated the values of our tradition. We kept Jews as rugged individuals. We trained their minds. We refused to allow them to become simply part of the lumpen proletariat, simply part of the mass. Now, there were illiterate Jews, there were poor Jews, there were ignorant Jews, but by and large, in Jewish life, we tried very hard to develop the skills inherent in every human being. And because we did so, democracy is coherent with Jewish life. We're a difficult people to manage, but we're a wonderfully effective people as a catalyst, as Casimir the Great recognized in the 14th century, as the communities of Spain recognized in the 15th and 16th century, where when we are in a community, somehow the community begins to bubble culturally, economically, socially. And when we are pushed out of exile, pushed out, the community loses some of its elan, some of its spirit. Now, the Jews will no longer revive Poland. We're no longer there in any numbers. The handful of Jews in Solidarity, believe me, had very little to do with the whole Solidarity experience. But if the Poles, despite their anti-Semitism, could become Jews, much could happen. And that, I think, is the future, the happy future, if there is to be one, for that unhappy land. Amen.